met in person would be tasked to give short updates from their locations, places like the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, Yemen, the National Security Agency headquarters at Fort Meade, or a small base along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Sitting in a small room, often alone, they would have the daunting experience of giving a televised presentation to a 50-plus-year-old general and an intimidating group of experienced warriors and intelligence professionals. Few slept the evening before, and it would have been simple for me to unintentionally, even unconsciously, make it a terrible experience for them. When their turns came and their faces suddenly filled the screen, I made it a point to greet them by their first name, which often caused them to smile in evident surprise. They were 8 levels down the chain of command and many miles away. How did the commanding general know their name? Simple. I had my team prepare a cheat sheet of the day's planned briefers so I could make one small gesture to put them at ease. As they briefed me, I tried to display rapt attention. At the conclusion, I'd ask a question. The answer might not be deeply important, and often I knew it beforehand, but I wanted to show that I had listened, and that their work mattered. Some were flustered by the question. They would sigh in relief when they made it through their briefing, but it also gave them a chance, in front of the entire command, to show their knowledge and competence. For a young member of the command, even if the brief had been terrible, I would compliment the report. Others would later offer them advice on how to improve, but it didn't need to come from me in front of thousands of people. When we did it right, the analyst left the O&I more confident about, committed to, and personally invested in our effort. "Thank you" became my most important phrase, interest and enthusiasm my most powerful behaviors. In a small room with trusted advisors, frustration or anger can be put into context and digested, but the daily O&I was large enough that petulance or sarcasm could be disastrous. More than anything else, the O&I demanded self-discipline, and I found it exhausting. But it was an extraordinary opportunity to lead by example. I adopted a practice I called thinking out loud, in which I would summarize what I'd heard, describe how I processed the information, and outline my first thoughts on what we should consider doing about it. It allowed the entire command to follow and correct, where appropriate, my logic trail, and to understand how I was thinking. After I did that, in a pointed effort to reinforce empowered execution, I would often ask the subordinate to consider what action might be appropriate and tell me what he or she planned to do. Thinking out loud can be a frightening prospect for a senior leader. Ignorance on a subject is quickly obvious, and efforts to fake expertise are embarrassingly ineffective. I found, however, that asking seemingly stupid questions or admitting openly, "I don't know," was accepted, even appreciated. Asking for opinions and advice showed respect. The overall message reinforced by the O&I was that we have a problem that only we can understand and solve. Gardeners plant and harvest, but more than anything, they tend. Plants are watered, beds are fertilized, and weeds are removed. Long days are spent walking humid pathways or on sore knees examining fragile stalks. Regular visits by good gardeners are not pro forma gestures of concern. They leave the crop stronger. So it is with leaders. The military term is battlefield circulation, and it refers to senior leaders visiting locations and units. I found that these trips, like almost everything, benefited from careful planning and focused execution. Most of these visits had multiple objectives: to increase the leader's understanding of the situation, to communicate guidance to the force, and to lead and inspire. A good visit can accomplish all three, but a bad visit can leave subordinates confused and demoralized. Visits offer an opportunity to gain insights absent from formal reports that have passed through the layers of a bureaucracy. I found it helpful to communicate before the visit the primary questions I had and to ask for background information I could review before arriving. On-site, briefings from the local leadership were appropriate, but they needed to be accompanied by less formal interaction with individuals further down the chain. It was pointless to bring junior members to big meetings in front of their entire chain of command and expect candor, but I found that creating the right venues was easy to organize. There's an art to asking questions. Briefings are valuable, but normally communicate primarily what the subordinate leader wants you to know, and often the picture they provide is incomplete. Thoughtful questions can help fill in the blanks. Early in 2005, my intelligence officer, then Colonel, later Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, taught me a great technique. We were visiting a unit that boasted of having more than 250 intelligence sources, Iraqi civilians recruited to pass information to U.S. forces. I was deeply impressed. Mike then asked a simple question. Can you describe your very best source? I'll assume that all the others are less valuable. The unit admitted that the best was new and unproven, and in an instant it was clear that their source network had little real substance. I later used a specific question when talking to junior officers and sergeants in small bases in Afghanistan. If I told you that you weren't going home until we win, what would you do differently? At first they would chuckle, assuming I was joking, but soon realized I wasn't. At that point, most became very thoughtful. If they were forced to operate on a metric of task completion, rather than watching the clock until they went home, the implications would be significant. Almost all were good soldiers and leaders, but they had been shaped into thinking in terms of their tour of duty, a time horizon that rarely predicted successful mission completion. Once they recalculated, their answers were impressive. Most adjusted their approach to take a longer view of solving the problem. You might expect them to seek a quicker solution and an earlier ticket home, but they were experienced enough to know that real solutions demand the long view. Simple fixes are illusory. Although I couldn't change the troop rotation policy, as I left, I'd ask each soldier to execute his or her duties with that mindset. Communicating during visits is nonstop, from small group meetings with leaders to town hall talks to larger groups. I found it essential to let members of the command hear directly from me. I'd often start by standing in front of them and asking them to look into my eyes and decide over the next hour if they trusted me. I told them I was doing the same with them. You have the right to judge in person the leader who represents you, and I have the right to size you up as well. I avoided talking down to them, and I tried to understand and respect their perspective. It was often difficult. Soldiers fighting a daily battle under frightening conditions can feel their leaders are far removed from their reality. There's no magic cure for this challenge, and soothing words that aren't backed up by action encourage cynicism. If, after hearing their problems or concerns, I couldn't do anything about them, I found it far better to state that directly than to pretend I could change things. Simple honesty shows and earns respect. It is important to be realistic. Visits are often planned by well-intentioned, energetic staff members who plan more activities than can be accomplished. Hurried, drive-by interactions leave subordinates frustrated. If you come to ask questions, leave enough time to listen to the answers. And remember that even senior leaders are human. Congressional delegations would often arrive in Iraq so exhausted by the long flight and their jammed schedules that they would doze off as we tried to explain what we were doing. It is hard to learn or express support for the force if you are asleep. Over my career, I'd watched senior leader visits have unintended negative consequences. Typically, schedules were unrealistically overloaded and were modified during the visit to cancel parts of the plan. On the surface, it might be the necessary decision, but invariably soldiers who had spent days preparing a briefing or demonstration for the great man's visit were informed at the last minute that all their work had been for naught. It was not a good way to improve morale. I would tell my staff about the dinosaur's tail. As a leader grows more senior, his bulk and tail become huge, but like the brontosaurus, his brain remains modestly small. When plans are changed and the huge beast turns, its tail often thoughtlessly knocks over people and things. That the destruction was unintentional doesn't make it any better. The way forward. Leading a team of teams is a formidable task. Much of what a leader must be and do has fundamentally changed. The heroic, hands-on leader whose personal competence and force of will dominated battlefields and boardrooms for generations has been overwhelmed by accelerating speed, swelling complexity, and interdependence. Even the most successful of today's heroic leaders appear uneasy in the saddle, all too aware that their ability to understand and control is a chimera. We have to begin leading differently. Creating and leading a truly adaptive organization requires building, leading, and maintaining a culture that is flexible, but also durable. The primary responsibility of the new leader is to maintain a holistic, big-picture view, avoiding a reductionist approach, no matter how tempting micromanaging may be. Perhaps an organization sells widgets, and the leader finds that he or she loves everything about widgets, designing, building, and marketing them. That's still not where the leader is most needed. The leader's first responsibility is to the whole. A leader's words matter, but actions ultimately do more to reinforce or undermine the implementation of a team of teams. Instead of exploiting technology to monitor employee performance at levels that would have warmed Frederick Taylor's heart, the leader must allow team members to monitor him. More than directing, leaders must exhibit personal transparency. This is the new ideal. As the world becomes more complex, the importance of leaders will only increase. Even quantum leaps in artificial intelligence are unlikely to provide the personal will, moral courage, and compassion that good leaders offer. Persuading teams to network with other teams will always be difficult. But this is a culture that can be planted and, if maintained, can flourish. It just requires a gardener, a human and sometimes all too human leader displaying the willingness to accept great responsibility remains central to making an ecosystem viable.
Recap. Although we intuitively know the world has changed, most leaders reflect a model and leader development process that are sorely out of date. We often demand unrealistic levels of knowledge in leaders and force them into ineffective attempts to micromanage. The temptation to lead as a chess master, controlling each move of the organization, must give way to an approach as a gardener, enabling rather than directing. A gardening approach to leadership is anything but passive. The leader acts as an eyes-on, hands-off enabler who creates and maintains an ecosystem in which the organization operates.
Part 5. Looking ahead. The first duty imposed on those who now direct society is to educate democracy, to put, if possible, new life into its beliefs, to purify its mores, to control its actions, gradually to substitute understanding of statecraft for present inexperience and knowledge of its true interests for blind instincts, to adapt government to the needs of time and place, and to modify it as men and circumstances require. Alexis de Tocqueville. Chapter 12. Symmetries. The funeral of the high-level AQI leader Abu Zar followed a familiar pattern, a wake-like outdoor gathering and then burial. In the late summer of 2005, we watched the event through predator surveillance and accepted his death with mixed feelings. Removing an operative as effective as Abu Zar from the battlefield reduced the threat of VBIEDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, in Baghdad. But it eliminated our opportunity to question him on AQI's Baghdad network and operations. The fact remained, however, that he was dead. Or so we thought. On January 6, 2006, one of our liaison officers reported that Iraqi forces had captured an individual they believed was Abu Zar, very much alive. The funeral had been an elaborate ruse to throw us off his trail. Alive and in our control, Abu Zar began to cooperate in our search for Zarqawi. Intelligence reporting on Zarqawi had varied in volume and specificity through the summer and fall of 2005. We had monitored rumors that he was badly wounded and recovering in Syria. We listened to his broadcasts to various insurgent groups inside Iraq, and we even tracked a young Iraqi reported to be his latest wife, hoping for a lead. But in the spring of 2006, the young thug from Zarqa was free and more effective than ever. Still, I was increasingly confident that his days were numbered. Our understanding of his organization and of Zarqawi himself had grown dramatically. More significant, so had the task force's effectiveness. Our pathetic intelligence abilities of October 2003 were a far cry from the sophisticated organization we had become. Despite events like the February 2006 AQI bombing of the Shia Golden Mosque in Samarra, which ignited a hurricane of sectarian violence across Iraq, the task force was vastly more effective than it had been, with greater abilities than ever before for targeting Zarqawi and destroying his network. A curious incident reinforced my confidence. Through some adept technical work, we captured the raw digital footage of a propaganda film AQI was making. It showed Zarqawi, clad in his signature black, shooting weapons amid some nondescript dirt berms. The video reflected a catch-me-if-you-can cockiness crafted to enhance his warrior leader image. But before AQI could release its edited version, we released the outtakes. Zarqawi fumbling amateurishly with an automatic weapon, one of his henchmen grabbing a white-hot barrel with predictable results. More important, through some stunningly impressive work, analysts in D.C. were able to pinpoint the location where the scenes had been filmed. Our team of teams was now able to network its expertise quickly and effectively. In early April, tipped off by back-from-the-dead Abu Zar, an intelligence sergeant major named Walter began watching a farmhouse in a rural area west of Baghdad. After weeks of surveillance, he saw indications of an AQI meeting. No order or plan had directed his surveillance of the location he labeled NAI, named Area of Interest, 152. But after years in Iraq, he intuitively connected the dots. Within minutes of seeing what looked to him like an AQI gathering, Walter passed the information to the task force, recommending an immediate strike. A daytime raid was not a decision taken lightly. Flying in hostile airspace and landing close enough to the target that the suspects could not escape put our forces at risk. Because the operators trusted Walter's expertise and instincts and were themselves immersed in the intelligence process, they assessed the risk and made a decision almost instantaneously. The operators struck at 1:56 p.m. The resulting firefight killed five insurgents and revealed an arsenal of weapons, suicide vests, and other munitions. While the operation was still ongoing, surveillance noted activity at a farmhouse a short distance away. Walter and other analysts judged that it warranted targeting as quickly as possible. As soon as the firefight at NAI 152 concluded, the operators called an audible and brought in Night Stalker helicopters to raid the suspected meeting at the neighboring farmhouse, now named Objective Mayor's. There was no time to get approval from Task Force headquarters, no time for a rehearsal, and no written operations order. The seasoned teams simply stood by the choppers, listened to the Sergeant Major's assessment over the radio, developed a plan, and flew to the objective within minutes. They landed on target 2 hours and 15 minutes after beginning the firefight at NAI 152. The halting mechanics of 2003 seemed a lifetime ago. No shots were fired in the second raid as the raid force captured 12 Iraqi men. But red flags became apparent immediately. The men were obviously not farmers, and in a country where everyone seemed to carry a phone, we found only one between them. Either they had deliberately not brought them, or had thrown them into a nearby canal when they heard the helicopters. The men were detained and brought in for interrogation. A statement in the following afternoon's Operations and Intelligence video teleconference made me take immediate notice. "This is not just a bunch of fighters. These guys are different." Like the Old West scouting report that things are too quiet, the statement carried tremendous significance. The briefer was one of our most experienced intelligence officers, a veteran of operations against the Abu Sayyaf, Al-Qaeda-associated insurgent movement in the Philippines, as well as years of operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. He knew what was normal. So different stood out. Within days, our analysts had identified several of the men as mid-level AQI operatives. Our teams also began a deliberate effort to determine if any was a senior leader or directly connected to one. They compared the men's stories for inconsistencies and asked each of the men to identify who among them was the most important. Interestingly, all 12 identified the same man, including the man himself. While a significant AQI operative, he did not turn out to be the man who led us to Zarqawi. Earlier in the fight, such a guileless approach would have appeared stupidly simple to us. But we had learned that if it's stupid and it works, it isn't stupid. Initial suspicions bounced from one man to another until we focused on a confident middle-aged man we will call Alawi. In the days ahead, as the fight against AQI raged on across Iraq, we worked to understand who Alawi was. Alawi's interrogation team wasn't the only group focusing on him, nor were the intelligence analysts working around the clock in adjacent plywood-walled rooms. Our entire network, our teams across Iraq, intelligence agencies back in the United States and in the United Kingdom, headquarters of partner units across the region, and more than 70 liaison teams that the task force had positioned in headquarters, offices, and other critical locations, joined in the effort. Across the network, teams coordinated the questions asked, shared the answers received, proffered suggestions, and exchanged insights. It was a battle of wits, and we now had harnessed thousands of minds. Nobody's brain had been left in the footlocker. In mid-May, after dozens of patient interrogation sessions, Alawi decided to give us what he knew we wanted, a connection to Zarqawi. He told us that he knew the identity of Zarqawi's spiritual advisor, a man named Sheikh Abd al-Rahman, who had regular face-to-face interaction with our target. It was the critical piece of the puzzle. All we had to do was find Rahman and follow him to Zarqawi. Easier said than done. Rahman lived in Baghdad, which in May 2006 was becoming a post-apocalyptic shell of its former self. AQI-driven violence, highlighted by horrific car bombs, had already drenched the capital in blood when Shia rage over the Golden Mosque bombing erupted. Moving around the streets on operations or conducting surveillance became remarkably difficult. Sunnis were stopped at Shia checkpoints, pulled from vehicles, and executed on the spot. In raided AQI safe houses, we found medieval-like torture chambers with photographs and videos documenting sectarian sadism. We located a man we believed to be Rahman living with his family in a Baghdad neighborhood, and we readied both ground and air teams to maintain unblinking surveillance and PID, or positively identify, the suspect up close. But keeping constant track of an individual who does not want to be found was challenging, even with our vastly improved technology. An age-old quandary emerged: the decision to strike or hold. We felt we had eyes on Rahman and hoped to watch him patiently until he led us to Zarqawi. But we knew the dynamic could change any day. If we struck immediately, we could probably capture Rahman. But unless he cooperated almost immediately, Zarqawi would be alerted and disappear. If we waited and watched, there was a greater chance we would spook the advisor, Zarqawi might move for other reasons, or any number of black swans might arise and disrupt our scheme. To add further tension to our decision, massing enough surveillance assets to maintain unblinking surveillance of Rahman diverted us from other potential operations at a time when Baghdad was melting down. Information flowed, options were tabled and argued over. Patience is hard when people are dying. In the time before our creation of force-wide shared consciousness, tribal instincts would almost certainly have derailed our focus. Teams not involved in the Zarqawi hunt would have made far more noise about their need for ISR assets. Thanks to the common purpose that suffused our task force, people understood, and we pressed on. Finally, after 17 days of round-the-clock surveillance, we saw the spiritual advisor relocate his family to another house in Baghdad. It was an indicator. Alawi had told us that such a move meant Rahman was about to depart the city to meet with Zarqawi. We stared harder. Rahman's departure from Baghdad and journey to Zarqawi was pure drama. Watching from multiple command and control nodes, eyes straining to avoid missing even the smallest detail, we used our constellation of manned and unmanned surveillance aircraft to observe and record every move he made. I watched from Balad, knowing that, 8 time zones away in the United States, others were doing the same. We saw Rahman get dropped off on the side of a road on the outskirts of Baghdad and be picked up almost immediately by a blue bungo truck. A bungo truck is a flatbed pickup truck produced by South Korean Kia Motors since 1980 that is popular in Iraq. This almost textbook vehicle swap, a move designed to confound anyone attempting to follow him, was oddly reassuring. Innocent civilians don't work to shake possible tails. A small restaurant in Bakuba, the capital of Diyala province, was the scene of Rahman's next tactic. Entering a side door, he exited another a few minutes later to climb into a white pickup truck and drive off. The pickup had a surprisingly familiar look. Zarqawi was known to use multiple similar trucks to confound aerial surveillance. As we followed the pickup, we also maintained eyes on the original sedan Rahman had taken from Baghdad and on the restaurant, in case the man who left was not him. Had we been limited to a single aerial surveillance platform, as we had been in 2003 or 2004, we would have been forced to choose which to watch and left to hope our observation skills and luck were good. Now, thanks to our team's willingness to pool resources, we were able to have different aircraft maintain their constant stare on each target. Throughout the process, we mapped out connections and plotted locations, targets we would strike after doing our best to get Zarqawi. The house Rahman drove to was in an area called Hibhib. A driveway led from the main road, spanned a small canal, then dead-ended at a concrete and stone house that would have been a respectable addition to most American neighborhoods. The tree-lined road carried little traffic. As Rahman drove up to the house, a man came out to greet him and escorted Rahman inside. The man then walked back out and moved down the length of the driveway to the road. He wore all-black robes and cut a commanding presence. At the end of the driveway, he looked left and right and turned before going back inside. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. We had talked for 2.5 years about this moment, but decision time is never as neat and clean as you envision it. Going after him was a given, but the question was, how? The unit that controlled our operations in Iraq operated about 30 feet from me inside our headquarters at Balad. Their commander and I spoke briefly as he confirmed his confidence that the man was Zarqawi and said he intended to strike. He launched a raid force from Baghdad, but as a backup also had F-16s ready to bomb. He didn't ask permission, and I didn't ask him to ask. I'd learned that trust was critical. Deviating from the modus operandi we had worked so hard to foster, even when the stakes were high, would be a mistake. As always, events diverged from plan. The Baghdad-based raid force was delayed by helicopter maintenance problems. We had a very limited time window in which to strike. Behind the house sprawled a grove of palm trees. Tracking someone who managed to flee into the palms, particularly as darkness approached, would require hundreds of soldiers and more luck than we wanted to bank on. The commander turned to Plan B, the F-16s. But one of the aircraft was off station for refueling. Critical minutes were ticking by. Finally, a second F-16 made its way to the target. After a jaw-clenching delay of several minutes, it dropped its ordnance. We watched the stone and concrete house containing the man who had masterminded AQI's reign of terror disappear in a cloud of smoke. When the raid force landed, about 28 minutes after the bombs, they found local Iraqi police on site with an ambulance. Zarqawi lay on a stretcher, still alive. An American medic who understood the tremendous value of a live Zarqawi in custody worked to save him. But he died 24 minutes later of internal injuries. They brought Zarqawi's body directly back to Balad. Lying on a mat on the concrete floor, the body showed no external injuries. and looked exactly as we'd seen Zarqawi in photographs. Still, to avoid any possibility of error, we passed the fingerprints back to the FBI in the United States and waited impatiently for them to confirm the identification before any leadership could announce the operation. As we waited, we amassed intelligence on the targets we had identified during the chase. We also conducted a planned intercontinental farewell party for then Rear Admiral Bill McRaven, a SEAL who had been a key element in the command for almost 3 years. He would later lead the task force and then United States Special Operations Command. That night he got the usual good-natured ribbing from people who admired him. We conducted his farewell digitally. Bill and his wife, Georgianne, gathered at Fort Bragg with staff and families there, while my command team from Balad, our other deputy commander from Afghanistan, and other members of the command from around the region participated by video teleconference. We joked, told stories, and passed gifts to Bill. To the uninitiated, it would have seemed a strange gathering. But by June 2006, our distributed network felt oddly normal. We had become a new command of a new age. As we celebrated, a staff officer walked in and whispered in my ear. My wife, Annie, told me later that as she watched my reaction on the screen, unaware of the operation, she knew something significant had happened and prayed it was not more casualties. It wasn't. We had just received confirmation that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was dead. Now our task forces across Iraq swung into action. Over the course of the evening, they struck targets as quickly as possible, including 14 in Baghdad alone, hoping to hit each before word of Zarqawi's death prompted the AQI operatives to move. We had placed these strikes on hold before, concerned they could prompt Zarqawi to vanish. Such simultaneous strikes had the special potential to shock AQI's network, and at each target we gathered more intelligence, identified more connections, and prepared to maintain pressure. In the moment, the operation against Zarqawi seemed like the most important thing in our lives. And perhaps at the time it was. The processes, relationships, and trust that underpinned that complex effort were by now things we almost took for granted. We used them every day and night as though they were the natural order of things. Inside, however, most of us knew just how much it had taken to bring that natural order into being. The Star Wars Bar. The organization that pulled this off was a world apart from the organization that failed to prevent the sewage plant bombing in September 2004. Driven by the necessity to keep pace with an agile enemy and a complex environment, we had become adaptable. We had fused a radical sharing of information with extreme decentralization of decision-making authority. In doing so, we had a structure unlike any force the U.S. military had ever fielded. Gone were the tidy straight lines and right angles of a traditional MISI org chart. We were now amorphous and organic, supported by crisscrossing bonds of trust and communication that decades of managers might have labeled as inefficient, redundant, or chaotic. By 2007, the task force was winning the fight against AQI. Our thinking had become smarter and our execution more nimble. We were learning and adapting quicker than the enemy and finally hitting them faster than they could regenerate. We hit targets every night, but also started striking during the day, something we never could have done without the superior intelligence capabilities and trust between our operators and analysts that had been bred by our network. Of course, this was only one piece of the war at large, and the fact that we had gained an edge over AQI, though it greatly behooved coalition forces, did not represent the be-all and end-all of the war. Nor, sadly, would our suppression of AQI outlast our presence in Iraq. A few years earlier, detainees would smugly dismiss our limited understanding of their organization. Now, they marveled at our intel, asking interrogators, "How are you doing this? How could you know that?" The answer was not some secret treasure trove of AQI data we stumbled across, or a technological breakthrough in surveillance. It was the very edge that AQI had once held over us, a revolution in the mundane art of management. Our performance flowed naturally from the interconnected neural network that our force had become. Walking into the SAR, once a place of disciplined stratification, a visitor would now see a teeming assembly of experts from across our force and the intelligence community. An analyst would be next to an operator, next to someone on rotation from one of our partner agencies, gathering information from Baghdad, Kabul, and D.C. We eventually dubbed it the Star Wars Bar, after the motley crew of aliens that populated George Lucas's extraterrestrial taverns. Though the elimination of Zarqawi represented a pivotal moment in our fight against AQI, it was just one small piece of the puzzle. In fact, the decentralization of authority that AQI had engineered and that we, in our own way, had adopted, meant that decapitation was no silver bullet. Our main strategy was to hollow out the middle ranks of the organization, which tended to be the most connected. An organization as regenerative and fluid as AQI would never possess a single point of failure, which was why it was important that we hit them relentlessly and accurately. AQI was adaptable, but Zarqawi's death was a major victory in morale. At long last, we were better. We had become not a well-oiled machine, but an adaptable, complex organism, constantly twisting, turning, and learning to overwhelm our protean adversary. In 1835, Alexis de Tocqueville published the first of two volumes of what is now considered one of the founding texts of political science, Democracy in America. He had just returned to his native France from a 9-month trip to the United States. At the time, a lazy backwater with a small economy whose chief relevance to Europe was its remarkable Revolutionary War a half-century prior. Tocqueville, however, looked at America and saw the future. As revolutions spread across Europe, upending monarchies and ushering in republics and democracies, he turned to the United States as an example of how to do it right. Visiting bustling eastern cities and exploring Midwest wilderness, Tocqueville was impressed by the almost complete equality of conditions in America. He was astounded by the high levels of civic participation in voluntary associations, writing that, "In no country of the world has the principle of association been more successfully used or applied to a greater multitude of objectives than in America." Tocqueville also wrote extensively on what he saw as America's vulnerabilities. Although people then and now tend to consider the essential tenet of democracy to be the political empowerment of the people, this alone does not produce a successful democracy. The people can be effectively empowered only if they have enough context to make good decisions. Tocqueville emphasized this point, noting that in the United States, the instruction of the people powerfully contributes to the support of the Democratic Republic. Political scientist Brian Danoff explains that Tocqueville saw leaders as charged with the task of educating democratic citizens and providing their understanding of freedom with a sense of purpose, a sense of what freedom is for. This critical caveat to Tocqueville's predictions of American democratic success cuts to the heart of what makes democracy tick. A political structure in which decision-making authority is, in some ways, decentralized to the voters rather than concentrated in a monarchic or oligarchic core, requires a high level of political awareness among the public in order to function. If people are not educated enough to make informed decisions at the polls, the feedback system on which democracy is premised will not work. The proliferation of democratic governments across the world over the past two centuries might suggest that the simple act of democratic decentralization itself is a recipe for success. But, as Tocqueville points out, one cannot make good choices without proper context. A democracy such as America could remain free only with a proper kind of education. In other words, a system requires shared consciousness before it can reap the benefits of empowered execution. Tocqueville recognized that empowerment without context will lead to havoc. This is the risk run if traditional, hierarchical organizations just push authority down. Ceteris paribus. Think of the 2008 financial crisis, largely sparked by young, uninformed finance professionals being given far too much leeway and far too little guidance. An organization should empower its people, but only after it has done the heavy lifting of creating shared consciousness. This is much harder when you are trying to achieve something constructive. AQI could dole out empowerment with relatively little shared consciousness because, with destruction as their primary goal, precision and coordination were not always necessary. But for most human endeavors, struggling to come to terms with a complex environment, everything from supply chain management to aid distribution to marketing to national governance, doing something constructive is essential to their mission. Empowered execution without shared consciousness is dangerous. Similarly, shared consciousness on its own, as we learned, is powerful but ultimately insufficient. Building holistic awareness and forcing interaction will align purpose and create a more cohesive force, but will not unleash the full potential of the organization. Maintain this system for too long without decentralizing authority, and whatever morale gains were made will be reversed as people become frustrated with their inability to act on their new insights. Just as empowerment without sharing fails, so does sharing without empowerment. Shared consciousness is a carefully maintained set of centralized forums for bringing people together. Empowered execution is a radically decentralized system for pushing authority out to the edges of the organization. Together, with these as the beating heart of our transformation, we became a single, cohesive unit far more agile than its size would suggest. Unlike the items in a MISI checklist, neither of these can be instituted alone. Only when fused can they power an organization. As with team members, complex system components, and other dynamics we have discussed in the book, the union of shared consciousness and empowered execution is greater than the sum of their parts. The speed and interdependence of the modern environment create complexity. Coupling shared consciousness and empowered execution creates an adaptable organization able to react to complex problems. The relationship between context and authority is as ancient as it is intuitive, but it has usually been directed by improving the information given to senior leaders, thereby enhancing their decision-making purview. Tocqueville's application of this to the distributed governance of democracy is a historic exception. We reversed this direction. We used shared consciousness to pump information out, empowering people at all levels, and we redefined the role of leadership, gardeners. What we did would not have been possible 20, 10, maybe even 5 years prior. So essential to our approach were the information technologies we harnessed, nor would it have been necessary. Today, it is. A world without stop signs. This new world, the wayward swirl in which my granddaughter Emmylou will grow up, is equal parts exciting and frightening. Human interaction, not just in the context of management, is changing tremendously. The University of Texas at Austin computer simulation on the future of automotive traffic provides a perfect reflection of these shifts. The program illustrates how a four-way intersection might look in an urban landscape dominated by self-driving cars communicating in real time. And watching it somehow just feels wrong. The intersection is huge, a 10-lane highway crossing over another 10-lane highway. But there are no traffic lights, no stop signs, and seemingly no sense of order. Vehicles don't queue up based on direction of travel to wait their turn before migrating to the other side en masse. Instead, cars going in all four directions zip past one another at full speed, constantly within feet of a horrific T-bone. The intersection is never empty. No vehicle ever stands still. It doesn't even look like they slow down. Their trajectories can be plotted in coordination with one another long before arriving at the intersection. So there is no need for the stopping and starting that characterize human behavior under similar circumstances. It looks like a death trap. But driverless cars promise to reduce traffic fatalities significantly. UT Professor Peter Stone, one of the leaders of the project, notes that 25% of accidents and 33% of the 33,000 auto deaths each year in America occur at intersections, and 95% are attributable to human error. Early trials suggest that self-driving cars could save 10,000 deaths a year while making commutes faster and more comfortable. But for all the statistics and trials, the UT simulation still doesn't look right. It looks unnatural because we have a strongly ingrained idea of how traffic should look, and it is governed by a mechanical rhythm of stops, starts, and turns. In contrast to these satisfying, machine-like motions, the fluid mess in the simulation seems like dangerous disorder. Psychologists and organizational theorists call these heuristics for how the world works mental models. Mental models can be very helpful. They can provide shortcuts and keep us from reinventing the wheel. As The Onion put it tastefully, stereotypes are a real time saver. Problems arise when these models no longer reflect reality and when they inhibit creative thinking. We have to recognize that a mental model is not reality. It is just a representation of reality. And there are a near infinite number of equally valid representations, almost all of which also leave something out in the interests of simplification. A subway map of Washington, D.C. is no more right or wrong than a topographical map, but the former is useless for hiking, and the latter is useless for catching a train. Nonetheless, we have to avoid the temptation to confuse the map for the terrain, to believe that subway lines are the only true representation of a city, or that lights and stop signs are the only way to manage traffic. In the words of Albert Einstein, our theories determine what we measure. When we urge people to think outside of the box, we are generally asking them to discard mental models. In the case of traffic, our mental model is one in a family of models about how the world around us should be run, most of which are mechanistic, with clear rules and demarcations and categories that are readily visible to the naked eye. Standards, norms, and rules of engagement make us comfortable. This is effective. This is efficient. Things should not look like a chaotic, self-organizing mess. And for the past century, those models served us well. We are likely to see more and more chaotic mess solutions in the coming decades. We will need to confront complex problems in ways that are discerning, real-time, responsive, and adaptive. We will need systems capable of doing things that no single designer, however masterful, could envision. Things far beyond an individual planner's capacity to comprehend and control. Just as the intricate structure of ant colonies is beyond the single ant's 250,000 neuron brain. Anne Murray Allen, former head of IT and strategy for one of Hewlett-Packard's most profitable divisions, and University of Oregon social network researcher Dennis Sandow, teamed up for a series of studies on social network analysis. Reflecting on their research, they wrote, "As the philosophy of the physical sciences dominated the industrial age, the philosophy of the biological sciences is beginning to dominate the knowledge age. This philosophy views knowledge, people, and organizations as living systems, which represents a shift from, one, focusing on parts to focusing on the whole, two, focusing on categorization to focusing on integration. Insofar as organizations, armies, schools, governments, corporations are essential to solving the biggest problems we face, and the running of those organizations enables or disables their effectiveness, management determines the quality of the world we live in. Management has tapped the power of industry, sent men to the moon, saved the lives of the wounded and the sick, and won and lost wars. And now we need systems that can solve the complex systemic threats of climate change, brittle development aid flow, and networked terrorism. This makes management one of the fundamental limfacts to the quest for human progress, and as we look to solve bigger and bigger problems, we will need management systems that, like the UT traffic system, can adjust and adapt in real time, that are not constrained by the expired mental models of yesteryear. As complexity envelops more and more of our world, even the most mundane endeavors are now subject to unpredictability. And we can learn from those at the vanguard. In the 1960s, NASA was the exception. But today, it is the rule. Only a handful of entities have not found themselves surrounded by complexity. Supply chains, once reliable assembly lines, are now spread across the globe and subject to constant nonlinear disruption. Everything from a food shortage in Zambia to a disease outbreak in China to a storm in the middle of the Pacific can impact the delivery of a product packaged in the United States. An American lawn care company came to Crosslead for help because their line and block charts had become overwhelmed by the realities of a global economy, a complex supply chain, and the thicketed, overlapping network of relationships with suppliers, marketers, and consumers. Another client, a large technology company, struggled to integrate efforts across continents after a storm in Thailand wiped out production of their flagship product. Out of necessity, AQI invented a new solution to being effective in this new environment, as did we, and as, sooner or later, will everyone else. There is no such thing as an organizational panacea. The details will always be different for different people, places, and objectives. But we believe that our model provides a good blueprint. Eventually, we all have to take a leap of faith and dive into the swirl. Our destination is a future whose form we may not find comforting, but which has just as much beauty and potential as the straight lines and right angles of the past century of reductionism. This future will take the form of organic networks, resilience engineering, controlled flooding, a world without stop signs. Taylor, in the 1880s, gazed into a new era of technology brimming with opportunity and saw that the organization of human behavior would be a limfac. The potential gains in productivity promised by industrialization were being constrained by inconsistent